Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm so happy to be with all of you today. I have a wonderful guest who will be joining me later in the show, Josh Cook. He is the co-founder and CEO of Next Door Organics. And we'll tell you more about that company when he comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city and our country, and also talk to you about some things that are in the news and things that you can do to get involved. First, I put a couple things up on my website this week under Take Action that I'd really like to draw everyone's attention to. One, of course, is about saving bees. Neonicotinoids have been known to be one of the most important things to address in saving the bees. They are pesticide that is sprayed that is really killing bees. It's been outlawed already in the European Union, but for some reason our country, I shouldn't say for some reason, it's obvious why, our country is not willing to make it an illegal pesticide, even though there is proof that a senior scientist at the USDA did research on this, found that it was bad, and the USDA is trying to bury that research. So there's a petition that you can sign on my website to try to bring the USDA transparent. I know that's a far cry, unlikely to happen, but let's put the pressure on and try to put that research out into the open so that they have to do the right thing. So we need to give them that pressure. Another one is about Native American land grab. And we've all been hearing about land grabbing, you know, that's happening in third world nations and Africa. But here it is happening once again right in our own country, of course, with the Native American land that we gave to them as, you know, of course we thought, I'm sure, when we gave them that land that it was invaluable land and not worth much because we had already done the land grabbing with the Native Americans throughout history, so we finally gave the Apaches this little piece of land over, where is it, in Arizona, Oak Flat, and now they have found that it's very rich in copper. So, of course, there is a foreign-owned company called Resolution Copper that is trying to get rights to this land, and it looks like our government is going to give it to them. Congress has sneaked into this very important defense bill that they're trying to get through Congress. It's a must-pass defense bill. Well, they've snuck into it small print that says transfer this sacred land in Arizona to this multinational mining, copper mining company. And so we just can't let that happen. This company also has bad records as far as human rights and environmental records, and it would leave a two-mile-wide crater in the middle of the land as well. So it's really bad, but please sign the petition to help the Apaches stay on their land. Okay, some other things that I want to share with you. I know I keep talking about the new USDA guidelines. It's just so sad that since 1980, when they first started coming out with these guidelines, even back then, McGovern, I think, was in charge of writing the guidelines back then. And the lobbyists, you know, back then he was trying to suggest that people eat less meat and dairy products. And again, that is the recommendation, and that has been removed from the document. When is this going to stop? When is it going to stop that our government honors the profits and hears the voices of the lobbyists of the big corporations more than the people that we elect them to protect? It is just absurd to me, and it makes me so angry. And so we just have to all know that we can't just trust guidelines and information that comes out from different companies and groups, even within our own government. I mean, we just cannot trust it. We have to do our own research. We have to look at history. Look at what's been working for eons and follow that. I mean, we all have heard about the Mediterranean diet. We've also have heard about the blue zone diets, you know, looking at areas where people live over 100. Look at those and incorporate some of those ideals into your daily life, whether it's walking, exercise, eating clean, not eating too much, and mostly a plant-based diet. I mean, you know, I recognize that trying to or encouraging everyone to give up meat is not going to happen. As most of you know, I am not a vegan myself, you know, although that is predominantly how I choose to eat. And I think it's important for us all to adopt a more plant-based diet for our health and for the sustainability of the planet. And that has been coming up over and over again. It is really the way of the future and what we really need to encourage people to do. So please don't trust, you know, the latest reports you hear. Another thing in the news this week that I posted on my website is about the HPV vaccine. Now, back years ago when that first came out, I'm always skeptical when they come out with a new vaccine and they're like, oh, great, new vaccine, run, sign up and get it and give it to your kids. It just doesn't make sense that something comes out and all of a sudden everybody runs and goes and gets it. These things, very often, if you look again to history, the problems don't show up until decades later. And sure enough, that is what's happening. You know, they're finding, and actually also there was buried evidence or and research that was done at the very beginning that showed that the HPV virus caused inflammatory conditions in the body. And it's just unbelievable, again, that this got approved and that moms across the country are subjecting their young girls to this vaccination. It's just bad. I don't trust it. I don't trust most vaccinations in general. I'm not saying all vaccinations, but again, look to history. Do your research. Don't rely on the medical industry telling us what we should do and what we shouldn't do, because they have their hands in deep pockets with the pharmaceutical companies, and they're all in cahoots together. And it's really sad, but it's the truth. And I was not always so cynical. I didn't grow up that way, but I have come to become that way as I see the distrust that happens over and over again within our government and corporations. So please, everybody, just don't take things for face value. Do the research and make your own decisions. And help support the rights of those trying to make their own decisions. I know there's a group right now, you know, really pushing the whole vaccine issue, because I believe they made it a law that all kids, before they attend public school, have to be vaccinated. I know in California, there used to be an exemption for religious freedom. They tried taking that away. I believe that has been won back. But, you know, it's something you need to look into. We need to have our rights as parents. We cannot be forced and pressured to give things that we believe are bad to our children. Just imagine what would happen if everybody had to take everything, even if they felt like it was bad. And then 10 years later, we find out, uh-oh, all our girls are sterile. Uh-oh, no more babies. The end of our civilization. It just would be really, really horrible. So let's all do our own research and not believe the corporations and the industries that are going to be making profit off of the information they give us. Lots of things going on in the city and in our area, and some a little bit out of our area. January 18th through February 5th is New York City Restaurant Week. That's always a fun opportunity to try restaurants that you otherwise might not get to go to. So check out some of the restaurants. You can go just Google New York City Restaurant Week, and you can see all the restaurants that are online. They have price-fixed three-course meals at reasonable prices. So you might be able to try a restaurant that you otherwise wouldn't get to. NOFA Winter Conference is coming up this weekend in Saratoga Springs at the Hilton. It's an all-weekend event. However, you can sign up and just go to certain days. At this point, you probably could just walk in and pay at the door, but go online and see what seminars are being offered, what day, and time your visit so that you can attend a workshop that really interests you. January 23rd is the Winter Bourbon Festival out here at TJ Finley's in Bayshore. You can go to their website to find out more about that. January 23rd through the 27th is the National Farmers Union 2016 Women's Conference. I guess if you're planning on going to that, you've already made that plan, but it should be a great conference, and most of the new young farmers coming up are women, and so it should be a really nice time of sharing, and it's in New Orleans, which is always a fun place to visit. January 26th, Slow Food, New York City is sponsoring the Manhattan Slur. They do that every month. They have basically a happy hour at a venue that they think Slow Food members would be interested in. And it's just an opportunity to meet the leadership of Slow Food New York City, find out more about what they're about. I am co-chair of Slow Food North Shore, which is one of the chapters on Long Island. And we also do events. We just secured a date for the next upcoming food and film festival that we have been doing for the last couple of years, and it's been a great success. So that's coming up March 29th, I believe, is the date. So save the date for that. Thursday, January 28th, this should be a really important event. Food and Water Watch is sponsoring an event, along with a lot of other sponsors, info evening about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how it would affect Long Island and why we would want to derail it. This partnership I've talked about many times over the years, last few years, as they've been negotiating it behind closed doors. It's now no longer being negotiated behind closed doors. It's now wide out in the open, and it's as bad as people had thought, possibly even worse. And so come on out and find out why it's bad, and why it's something that we should all band together and really oppose. It's good for corporations for a change and bad for the people. So we just have to turn this around. It's just ridiculous that our government keeps doing these things that are bad for us, bad for the constituents, but good for a business. You know, that just cannot be, the bottom line cannot be the end all to everything, to all decisions. January 30th through the 31st, there's an Awaken Wellness Fair, and that is an event with over 100 holistic health exhibitors. It's at the Pentop Ballroom in Manhattan. The organizer is Awaken Wellness, so you can go to their website to find out more about that. This is coming up is the, I don't know, the annual New York City Chili Fest. I don't know how many years they've been doing it, but this happens every year over the last few years at least, and it takes place at the Chelsea Market. This one is on Sunday, January 31st, and it benefits Wellness in the Schools, which is a wonderful organization that's really bringing food consciousness into the schools, and both through healthy food and exercise. And it's a great organization. It's a nonprofit. And so come down to the Chili Fest and you'll help support that. It's from 7 to 9 on Sunday the 31st. February 3rd, there's a Slow Food Wine Tour coming up, and they're stopping in New York. I still don't know where that's going to be. I know I've been telling you I will find out, and I will let you know next week. February 8th through 9th is the Soil and Nutrition Conference. That's in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, by the BioNutrient Food Association. And I took their course up at Stone Barns Educational Center in Tarrytown a couple of years ago. It was so informative. I really recommend it if you are a new farmer, gardener, person that wants to enrich your soil. It's very informative. Tuesday, February 9th, Food Almanac is taking place at the Brooklyn Winery, and that's sponsored by Slow Food New York City. It is $45 for members and $55 others. To find out more information about it and for all these events, you can go to my website at ieatgreen.com or onto the Slow Food New York City website. Also coming up February 13th is the Long Island Regional Seed Consortium's Seed Swap, and that's a wonderful opportunity to find out about some unusual and different seeds that people have been growing here on Long Island. And whenever you use seeds that have been established in a certain region, they grow that much better. So it's great to get some local seeds. Lots of other things coming up, but I don't want to take any more time. Save the date, March 13th, for the Just Food Conference. Also, April 8th and 9th is a Food and Enterprise Summit in Brooklyn. Save the date for that. And all, like I said, all these things you can find out more on my website. But now I want to share with you my recipe for the week before I invite Josh Cook on. My recipe this week is a Moroccan tofu with hot sweet peppers, raisins, and pistachio nuts. I don't know what inspired me, but I felt inspired. And, you know, one of the things I love to do is to take dishes that are traditionally made with another protein and do it with one of my favorite vegetarian proteins, whether it's tofu, tempeh, seitan, or beans, so that I can create really full, satisfying main courses for vegetarians so that they're not feeling like they're being left out with of a main meal. Very often as a vegetarian, when you go to someone's house and, you know, you're given the rice and the sides, vegetable and salad, yeah, that's enough, but you still kind of feel a little gypped, like you're missing the main course. So I'd never like my guests to feel that way, so I always like to have a vegetarian main course. And here is a great one. So I start with one 20-ounce block of super firm sprouted organic tofu. And this tofu entered the market a few years back, and it's really firm, and it's a great one for sautéing. And it's 20 ounces, so it's a little bigger than the other ones. The other ones used to be a pound. Now they've cut them back to 14 ounces or 15 ounces. So this is 20 ounces, so it's a little bit bigger. It's really firm, and it's easy to cut into cubes and have it hold its weight. I first cut it into thirds, and then I press it between some towels to remove some of the water. So you need one of those. Then you need 2 teaspoons of chopped garlic, 2 teaspoons of chopped ginger, some olive oil, 3 teaspoons of Ras El Hanout. It's a North African spice mix. Everybody, and welcome back. Sorry about that technical difficulty, but it's now time for me to introduce my guest today, Josh Cook. Josh is the founder and CEO of Next Door Organics, and Next Door Organics is a weekly delivery service of high-quality, sustainable local organic foods, which they box up on a weekly basis and deliver either directly to your door or they have drop-off sites. But their vision is to connect clients and people with their local farms and local producers, small batch food makers, artisanal producers, and they do this by delivering a box of delicious weekly foods to your door, or sometimes they also have drop-off sites, but I'll let Josh tell us more about it. Josh, are you with me?
Yes, thanks for having me on.
Sure, well, welcome. Next Door Organic sounds like the new wave of like a personal CSA delivery service. Is that how you describe it?
Yeah, that's what we've had in mind since we started it a few years ago. And we are really interested in kind of revolutionizing the easiest connections that people can have to their local farm-made, you know, sources of products or small batch makers of food. And now that there's this kind of growing green revolution underway, you know, we're seeing even more diverse sources of food for city dwellers that include rooftop-grown greens and hydroponics and regional foragers. So it's an exciting time to be sourcing and working with foods from the local food shed. And we really just kind of get excited every day finding these things and then packing them up into subscriptions for our members around New York City.
So how does it work? Do people order online?
Exactly, yeah. We on our site, anyone can create an account and set a subscription up weekly or biweekly or monthly. We have various size packages and a lot of control over your frequency and size of orders. When we first started, I started this with my co-founder at a farmer's market stand in Brooklyn in 2011, and we were hearing a lot of feedback from our first customers about their experiences with the existing options to get access to local food. Either farmers markets or a lot of people had experiences with traditional CSAs or community-supported agriculture programs. And what we were hearing is that there was a growing demand for sustainable food, but also a demand for more flexible options for getting access to it. And one of our core values as a company is to provide increasing access in terms of affordability for this type of food, which to our mind means comparing to the traditional CSA model, making it easier to join and not have to pay an upfront seasonal fee for produce. A traditional CSA usually is run by one farm, and it'll require at least half of a season, if not a whole season's payment upfront for the farmer, and then you get a share of the crop each week throughout the season. And while this model works really well for the farmers, it was developed as a model in the 70s to help stabilize the income of farmers and to help put control of their own income in their hands. It really puts a lot of the risk onto the consumer. And, you know, that's just frankly not a model that's going to last. You know, if the consumer absorbs all the risk, then it's not a model that's going to last pretty much. And so one of our main goals has been to diversify our sourcing network so that we can offer a CSA that goes around year, that goes all year round, and allows people to pay as they go. So especially for people who live in a city where there's, you know, vacations and, you know, moving around within the city, you know, people really feel like they want to have that level of control over how they're spending the money on their food. And we're happy to figure out that way and more ways of providing access to these sources.
Now, do people still have to join Next Door Organics? Is there a membership fee?
No, there's no membership fee. It's just a matter of setting up an account and making sure it's active. And then if anyone is on vacation or moves to Brazil for 6 months or whatever, they can deactivate their account and then not get any orders and not pay for anything. So it's very flexible.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's also what I've been hearing, you know, over the years. You know, people want that flexibility for when they go away. They don't want to have to try to find someone to take their vegetables that they've already paid for and not eaten. And I think also sometimes, although I actually like this aspect, but sometimes people don't like getting vegetables that they don't like.
Right.
And with the CSA, you get everything that they've harvested that week, and people sometimes like to have the choice as to what they're getting. However, as a chef, I think it's really exciting to give people vegetables that they otherwise wouldn't get, so that they, not are forced, but that they try and experiment with a vegetable that might be a little bit less familiar and hopefully like it.
Yeah, we get a lot of good feedback about, you know, from people who are finding it to be an exciting challenge each week to work with foods that they wouldn't choose themselves if left to their own devices in a grocery store. And this is an interesting kind of psychological kind of backstory to this part of our business, which I just find fascinating. There have been a lot of grocery psychology studies now, you know, over the last few decades about how do people behave in grocery stores, how do people choose their own foods. And it turns out that when people are left to their own devices, they end up purchasing the same 20 or so items over and over again for their own food supply. And even if they're interested and willing to try new foods, it's very hard for us to break out of our habits and our sense of familiarity with certain ingredients. So what this model ends up doing is kind of taking that amount of choice out of your hands and saying, hey, look, don't worry about picking which items you're going to get. We're going to guarantee it's great quality, local sources, sustainable sources, variety year-round. And then the only thing you have to worry about is what are you going to make with it? And then it turns into a game for people. And we've heard a lot of feedback from people about how it's a kind of empowering, exciting way to eat more variety each week.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know, even as a chef, that's one of the reasons, like the recipe I shared this week uses this spice mixture, Ras Hel Hanout, which, again, like I said, I'm not even sure if I'm saying it right because I've only seen it in cookbooks and printed. I've never heard anyone say it. But, you know, I use the same things over and over. And so when I look at a cookbook and I see a recipe that is using a different spice that I'm not familiar with, I want to play with it. I want to, you know, for me, it's a new color added to my palette, basically. And, you know, and as a creative chef, I want to experiment. So I'm happy to do the experimenting and then share it with people. And you're kind of doing the same.
Yeah. And there's so much about food diversity and how it impacts your nutrition that is kind of driving this point for us, because it's for us, nutrition is a huge component of how we communicate the value of what our service is all about. It's a chance for people to, like we said, get a variety of foods and kind of just like curate it and place in, you know, kind of get it into my fridge and then I'll figure out how to use it. And it helps people that they're cooking at home. This is a huge part of nutrition in our opinion, is that if you can cook at home, first of all, you're saving a lot. And then you are able to, if we can help you cook in ways that preserve the nutrition of your food, then your savings is multiplied even further. And so what we talk a lot about with our customers and our members is ways that you can work with food that help preserve the nutrition in the food. And that means recipes that involve raw, you know, raw techniques, ways to eat foods without cooking them, you know, and destroying some of their nutrition. Also preserving foods in ways that help kind of preserve the nutrition. Fermentation is a big aspect of that. This winter, we've actually had a partnership with a company upstate in Rochester where we've taken some of the summer harvest. They're a fermentary, actually. They do a lot of fermenting, and we get a lot of fermented foods from them. But this is the first year that they've tried a frozen line of foods from the summer, which we're distributing in our winter packages so that people can get that kind of nutritional profile throughout the winter also and have more diversity in their winter packages, you know, because we're sourcing nearly exclusively locally throughout the winter even. So it's nutrition is an important aspect of our whole operation, and it's one of the values that really drive how we communicate and educate our members.
Uh-huh. So do you provide recipes with the weekly box?
Yeah. The boxes aren't oriented around any particular recipes, but when we send out a list of what's in each package, we'll send along either recipes using some of the ingredients or tips for working with some of the ingredients, whether it's a recipe in particular or not. But really understanding the nutritional profile of your sunchokes or beets or parsnips helps you eat them, because then you can you can understand the motivation for why you'd want to pull a parsnip out of your drawer and make something with it. If you can understand how it's going to impact your own your own health and how you feel.
Uh-huh. Also, if you buy the produce in season when it's less expensive and process it in a way that's going to preserve it for when it's more expensive, that's mm-hmm. also a really nice thing. But one thing you touched on, actually a couple of things, I wrote a few notes. One, at the very beginning when you said, you know, this exciting green revolution, I just want to share with people out there, so often when people talk about the green revolution, that is what they named the industrial revolution. It was called the green revolution with all the pesticides and herbicides. So you have to know who's saying that word and pay attention every time people hear green revolution. We're not talking about the sustainable food movement that you and I are talking about. Very often people are talking about the green revolution as the introduction of GMOs and pesticides and herbicides so they can mass produce food. So that is just one thing I wanted to mention so that nobody got confused out there.
Good point.
But also, when we talk about cheaper food, you know, this makes it less expensive, and this whole idea for everybody out there that our food is supposed to be cheap. And, you know, I know my kids very often say, you know, it's cheaper for them to order Chinese food than to go out and buy all those ingredients and make it for themselves. And, you know, people have to realize that when you're ordering Chinese food, the vegetables you're getting, what you're eating is not of the same quality. And people have to value quality, and I think that's what you're trying to educate your clients about and what I'm trying to educate people about all the time, is that there is a difference. All broccolis are not created or equal, and I say that all the time. But the quality is a big thing. And I know you touched on that, you know, when we were talking prior to our interview about whether food is supposed to be cheap or expensive. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I think it's an interesting, you know, topic because, like you said, you know, accessibility, affordability is kind of a big, you know, heady topic around food. And when, you know, we're a company that's based in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, it's, you know, historically been a food desert. It's very hard to get access to sustainable foods in the neighborhood. And so we're very conscious of how do we help people understand what the value is of what we're offering. And that's why we are always in conversation about this concept of whether food is supposed to be cheap or expensive. And in the sense that if to take the argument that food should be expensive, it's in the sense that we should make sure that the people who make our food are being properly compensated for that because it's so important for us, that farmers' wages and that the labor that they're using on their farms is all up to the same standards that we have for the other aspects of our food, the quality and kind of ethics behind the labor situation within the food system is something that should translate, you know, it should translate all the way back to the labor situation at our farms. But then in terms of affordability and how do you talk to people about the difference between an apple that costs $1 versus an apple that costs 10 cents. And that's where really we get into the story of where is the food coming from? What are the additional uncounted costs of sourcing apples from China or from Chile? And, you know, what cost is it having on your own body when an apple that's been treated with all kinds of toxic gases for preservation in a shipping container for a few months on its route to you, what does that have? What kind of effect does that have on your body and the kind of downstream costs that would have? And then just in terms of like how to understand like what does, you know, you know, if you hand someone a bag, a $40 bag full of vegetables, and they're looking at it going, how does this translate into food, especially if they're a little leery about cooking, we really have to convince people who might be afraid of their own kitchens or afraid of their own abilities in their kitchens that cooking at home is the first step you make when you want to make your food more affordable. you have to commit to cooking more of your own food yourself. And then once you've decided to commit to cooking at home more, you have a choice of whether you're going to purchase food that's from more conventional industrial sources or food from sustainable, traceable sources. But either way, you're going to end up saving money compared to buying food from, you know, that's been processed at restaurants like the Chinese food. The amount of calories that the average American consumes every day is staggering. It's something like 4,000 calories or something like that, a totally unnecessary number of calories per person to get the nutrition that we need. So really, we all can be eating less food and saving more money by preparing our own food in at home and in a way that preserves the nutritional profile of the food so that our bodies can, you know, when you cook food in certain techniques, then food becomes more bioavailable. So your body can absorb the nutrition that's in the food, you know, a higher percentage of the nutrition that's in the food instead of just letting it all pass through. So it's a multifaceted, you know, kind of value proposition that we have to make about, you know, where does your food come from? How do you cook it? And how do you enjoy it? To really communicate, you know, what does food affordability and food access look like now?
Yeah, that's a big question. And, you know, it is a changing landscape. I mean, it's, you know, I feel like, you know, from when I first got into this 40 years ago to now, it's like day and night. I mean, so many more people are aware of it. You know, my kids, when they grew up and not eating sugar, I mean, people looked at me like I was a cruel, horrible mother not giving my children sugar. And now, you know, it's more common. I mean, more people, parents are thinking about that. I mean, of course, there's still the parents that are buying all the crap at the supermarket, but there's a lot of parents that realize that the food that they put into their kids is going to impact the health of their children. And that is a big step in the right direction.
One thing that has been really interesting to me, I have kind of a second life or past life interest in kind of alternative education and psychology related to child development and human development. And one of the fascinating intersections with this has been all the new research around the connection between your gut health and your mental health, and particular emotional health. There's a nerve connecting your gut to your brain called the vagus nerve, which has a big role in your emotional state. And there's been a lot of research about this connection and the relationship between your microbiome or your probiotic, you know, gut bacteria and your mental health. For people that are, you know, just for anybody, for everybody, as well as the whole realm of autism research that has gotten so much attention over the years. There's an increasing connection being drawn between the state of gut health and the emotional state or the symptoms of those who have been diagnosed with autism or autism-related, related
conditions.
Things.
I've had on Dr. Drew Ramsey, who's a psychologist up at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, and he, you know, instead of prescribing antidepressants to his patients, he prescribes healthy diets, and he totally sees, you know, you change somebody's diet, and they're no longer depressed. There's such a connection, you know, like you were talking about, and it's just, you know, it's really in its infancy stage as far as real medical research. However, those that have been able to use their intuition over years knew this years ago. You don't need studies to know that.
Sure.
You know, it just makes sense. You know, that's what I try to talk to people about all the time. Use your intuition. Use your, you know, your sense. I mean, you know, I've done Weight Watchers over the years because, you know, as a chef, I'm always struggling with my weight, but, you know,
you have access to a lot of good food, I bet. That's what.
Right. You know, and I would always tell people, you know, they're healthy calories. I'm not eating ice cream and cookies, but, you know, you have seconds if something tastes good, and portion control is as important as, you know, almost as important as what you're actually putting in your body. So, you know, overeating, as Michael Pollan said, you know, eat mostly plants and not too much. He said something else in there.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, exactly.
But that's really important.
Yeah, and that mind-body connection, I think, is the key. It's kind of, you know, being aware of how you feel after you eat something is really important. And a lot of people don't even make that connection. But it's just the first thing to notice is just the awareness of what did I just eat and how is it making me feel now? And, you know, I think that's something that needs to be brought more to the forefront in people's minds that helps them make choices about what they eat. So much of what drives our food culture right now and for a long time has just been familiarity, you know, our own particular cultural practices, wherever we happen to be, what our parents made when we were growing up, nostalgia for, you know, things that came from our childhoods. And really, when it comes to making our food choices now, I think a lot of people are going through like a relearning or re-education process for themselves where they're reprioritizing the nutrition of their food and the effects that they're feeling inside themselves rather than, you know, some how-to video that shows them how to make macaroni and cheese, fried macaroni and cheese balls on Facebook or something like that.
Isn't that unbelievable? You take something that's unhealthy and then how can we make it more unhealthy?
Yeah. And it'll make you drool, but it'll also make you feel gross afterwards.
Right. And, you know, and there are foods, you know, as a natural food chef, but also as a caterer, I know there's, you know, foods that are party foods, that are specialty foods, you know, special occasions, go for it. You know, it's like I'm also about the pleasure of food. And so if something might not be that healthy, but it really warms your heart, that's valuable too. But you got to really do it on occasion. You know, you got to really put those things in the proper perspective so that it is a treat and it is something that, you know, you might indulge in once or twice a year, but it's not something you can support your body on.
I think it's about the intention behind it. And, you know, we're all guilty of not being super intentional or always intentional with our food. I've definitely had my dollar pizza standing on the street here and there. And that's obviously not the kind of like food and community connection and intention that I'm talking about. So it's, you know, it's like we all have to kind of take it upon ourselves to make those decisions about like, you know, is this something that I really want to do, or is this something that I'm kind of being thoughtless about, or kind of it just happens to be convenient, even if it's not actually convenient in the sense that it's not actually providing me with the ultimate nutrition or ultimate sense of well-being that my body is asking for at the moment.
Right. So I just want to jump off topic for a little bit because you have some interesting history that I think many of my listeners would be interested in. I know that you are a woofer. You have gone traveling throughout Europe and actually worked on a couple farms in Europe.
Yeah,
through
I'd
the
like
woofing
to try it again
organization.
This summer.
What's that?
Yeah, I'd like to try it again this summer. It's a good way to travel if anyone's looking to travel this way.
Well, but can you share with everybody what woofing is? Because I think many of my listeners would be very interested if they knew about it, but I don't think many of them know about it. So can you share that?
Yeah, so woof is, it's WWOOF. It stands for Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. And it's essentially an online database that lists farms all over the world that are, that post a little paragraph profile of themselves asking for volunteers to come, and what they provide is a place to stay and food while you're living on the farm, and you work maybe 4 hours a day for a few days a week in exchange for your food and board. So it's a chance, and there's all kinds of different farms, vegetable farms, farms that raise animals, farms that are just starting up, farms that have a commercial component to them. So it's really a chance to, you know, experience the type of farm life that you might be interested in learning more about. So the experiences I've had, I worked at three different farms. The first one that I went to was in Hungary, in Western Hungary. It was an apple orchard, and it was just a small farm, not anything huge or commercial. I spent a lot of time pruning apple trees in the winter after, the apple season's in the fall. So the winter and spring is when the pruning happens to prepare for the next season. And, just kind of doing a lot of apple tree maintenance and work around that kind of a farm. So that was.
And was that all organic?
Yeah, it was an organic farm, but again, it was a very small farm, so it was more like apples for a local cider press and a local. Techniques for raising the apples, which is a particularly hard thing to do because apples are very disease-prone fruits. It was just an interesting experience. You learn a lot of the backstory of all the different aspects of farming and the markets for farm products through this. I remember hearing stories about in Europe how if you're an apple farmer in Hungary, for instance, you divide your best-looking apples and your ugly apples, and you send your best-looking apples to France or to the Western European countries for their markets, and the ugly apples stay in the East or get sold at more local markets. And it was just, at the time, it was an eye-opening kind of anecdote about how people end up valuing different foods and understanding where food comes from or what food is good food.
Interesting that they do that.
It was just one little story from that experience.
There's a movement actually in Europe, and I think it might have started in France, about the ugly fruit and really trying to promote ugly fruit. And, you can buy fruit that, tastes beautiful but might not look as beautiful, and you get it, discounted, or you give it to people that are otherwise hungry. I mean, it's just crazy how much food is getting wasted, and I think, that's been an issue that many of us have been talking about over the last bunch of years. 40%, I think it is, in this country, of our food is wasted.
Yeah.
So ugly fruit's a real one. So where else were you? You were in Hungary? Other country?
Yeah, and then from there, I spent some time at a farm next in Greece, and it was very much a startup farm. So I did just a lot of manual labor at that farm, making some raised beds. They were going to be growing basil, a lot of basil. They had a olive orchard that had been on the property for probably hundreds of years. Olives take a long time to get going, and this was kind of an old property, but they were starting up just starting to grow more diverse crop, essentially. And so what I had spent time there doing was making raised beds and preparing the soil for their upcoming planting season.
Mm-hmm. And then the last place you went?
The last place I went was definitely the most interesting. It was in the Netherlands, and it was essentially a commune. And it was like a group of people who were all friends with each other in one way or another, who had decided to buy an old Dutch farmhouse in the countryside and convert it into a kind of community living house. And they all had their own apartments, and they had a big community garden and a big community living space, and they had sheep and an orchard. And so I worked at that farm with another woofer, is what we call each other, another volunteer at the farm from New Zealand. For about a month and a half, we did all kinds of different farm projects in their greenhouse, in their orchards, with the sheep, in their garden. Learned a lot about growing different, the particulars of growing different crops, intercropping techniques, the timing of planting certain crops, and also just learning about community living. That was one of my first experiences in a kind of communal living environment, and it was fascinating and interesting and a lot of fun. And and now we've got similar kinds of farms that are in our Next Organic sourcing network that are upstate intentional communities and, you know, kind of communal living and farming communities that we've incorporated into our supply also. So maybe that's, maybe that experience in the Netherlands has kind of guided me in that direction for our current sourcing situation. But
yeah, well, intentional communities is a whole nother topic that, you know, one day I can have you come on. We can just talk about that because
that's really,
you know, I've been to an intentional community down in Costa Rica, and there's, you know, many, you know, springing up. I know there was a great article in the New York Times a couple of years ago, I think it was already, about a community out west that was, you know, instead of revolving around the golf course, it revolved, all the houses were built around the farm. And, you know, there's a cute little downtown area where, you know, your kids could, like, walk safely to the 5 and 10 store and get, you know, some healthy snacks. And, you know, there was one little restaurant in the town that you could get some healthy food. And it was just like a, it was like an old-fashioned little town that was all organic. And it was just great.
Yeah, so that's the future, I think, actually, is people who are really feeling a much deeper yearning and connection to spending their days working with food, having their immediate work be...
I'm not afraid.